Welcome to the Government Contract Legal Roundup, a podcast focusing on important developments facing government contractors and grant recipients. This podcast is put on by the Jenner and Block Government Contracts Practice Group. I'm David Robbins, co-chair of the group, and it's my pleasure to continue to host this podcast. Now, you should know, for some editions, we struggle to find content. Not this one. We have a lot going on. When I started doing government contracts podcasts, I would comment on how rare it was for the Supreme Court to take up government contracts cases. That's not true anymore. In the latest Supreme Court update, on June 1st, the Supreme Court issued a unanimous opinion in the SuperValu case. Supreme Court held that the False Claims Act scienter knowledge element refers to a defendant's knowledge and subjective beliefs, not to what an objectively reasonable person may have known or believed. This overturns a prior Seventh Circuit finding that its subjective intent is not relevant to False Claims Act scienter when the law says the defendant's actions were objectively reasonable. That's sort of, I guess, common sense. That's where the argument suggested the court was going to go, and that's where it ended up. We've got a regulatory update. A new FAR rule prohibits TikTok on information technology used or provided by contractors under federal government contracts. On June 2nd, the FAR Council issued an interim final rule that prohibits the presence or use of TikTok on IT used or provided by the contractor under a contract that includes this clause. I should note, I never learned how to use TikTok. My kids like it. I guess, you know, I'll just won't have any reason to learn in the future because the rule is effective immediately, given urgent and compelling reasons as a national security measure to protect government information and information and communication technology systems. It's being included in solicitations beginning on June 2nd and must be added to existing solicitations through amendment. It will also be added to existing contracts as part of new orders or option exercises. The rule prohibits the contractor from having or using a covered application on any information technology owned or managed by the government, and it goes on from there. Comments can be submitted prior to August 1st of this year. We have an interesting Federal Circuit claims decision to discuss. This one's Department of Transportation versus Eagle Peak Rock and Paving, Inc. Here, a divided Federal Circuit opinion provides a useful reminder of the standard of review applicable in CDA appeals. Here, a contracting officer terminated a contract for default based on concerns that the contractor was not making sufficient progress to complete performance on time. On appeal at the civilian board, the board converted the default into a convenience termination, and the government appealed to the Federal Circuit. The majority decision reversed and remanded the board's decision. The opinion focuses on the principle that the board was required to review de novo the contracting officer's default termination. The majority concluded that the board was too focused on identifying flaws in the contracting officer's rationale rather than determining in the first instance whether the termination was warranted. Judge Newman, dissenting, argued that the Federal Circuit panel should have gone ahead and decided, based on the record, whether the default termination was justified rather than remanding to the board for further litigation. This decision is a useful reminder of the de novo standard of review that applies to CDA appeals as compared to a more deferential standard of review like abuse of discretion, arbitrary, capricious, things like that, that apply to, for example, review of agency decisions in the bid protest process and in other contexts. These varying standards of review drive significant differences in how disputes are litigated and resolved. Another significant implication of de novo review of CDA claims is that a contractor's decision to appeal can place at risk any partial victory the CO may have provided in response to the claim. That is, if a contracting officer grants a contractor partial recovery in response to its claim, the board on appeal may well conclude that no recovery was warranted at all, depriving the contractor of even the partial win. All these factors are worth weighing as companies consider claims litigation. Let's talk about one protest case. And here's where, as you've heard me before, I'm going to struggle with pronouncing a name and I'm going to barrel through as if I know what I'm saying. I really don't, but give me a little bit of leeway here. Tionic Engineering and Agile Manufacturing LLC. This decision issued June 2nd. Here, GAO sustained a protest challenging the agency's price realism and reasonableness evaluations. GAO has consistently explained that price reasonableness concerns whether a price is unreasonably high, while price realism relates to whether the price is too low. Here, the protesters' price was more than four times the price of the lowest price awardee and nearly three times the price of the highest priced awardee. The Air Force concluded that the proposed prices of both protester and the awardees were simultaneously reasonable and realistic. The protester challenged this conclusion, and GAO agreed with the protester that the agency's evaluation was unreasonable, internally inconsistent, and did not explain the basis on which prices with a significant disparity could be considered both reasonable and realistic. Specifically, the agency relied on a government estimate, but the estimate stated that the final prices of three awardees still presented realism and reasonableness concerns. The agency also claimed that it relied on an analysis of other than certified pricing data, but the contemporaneous record failed to support this assertion. What's the takeaway? When a substantial disparity in prices exists, and an agency has concluded that the low price is realistic and the high price is reasonable, GAO will scrutinize the record to ensure that the agency has adequately explained its conclusion. We're also going to cover the Department of Defense Office of Inspector General audit report, which found inconsistent implementation of DOD's Controlled Unclassified Information Program, or CUI program. Background: the CUI program was established in the 2010 executive order to standardize the way the executive branch handles and marks information that is not classified but subject to safeguarding or dissemination controls required by law or policy. Previously, agencies used a wide variety of different markings, such as FOUO or SBU, for such materials. Agencies similarly instituted inconsistent safeguarding policies, often leading to unclear, overly restrictive dissemination policies. More than a decade later, no surprise, implementation is inconsistent. Many agencies have only recently begun to implement a CUI program. Others practice varying degrees of adherence to the CUI markings and dissemination requirements, and several DOD components that are also members of the intelligence community operate under an exigent circumstance waiver that permits continued use of legacy FOUO markings in certain situations. Relevant here, in 2020, DOD issued instruction 5200.48, establishing the DOD CUI program and providing guidance on its implementation. OIG's audit assessed the extent to which DOG developed guidance, conducted training, and oversaw the implementation of DOD's CUI program. Notably, OIG conducted the audit at the direction of the SASC, the Senate Armed Services Committee, in response to concerns that executive branch officials were improperly using limited dissemination control CUI markings to restrict sharing CUI without a legitimate rationale or to impede lawful congressional oversight. Let's stop there for just a second before I tell you what it found. This is really interesting, right? On the one hand, we have a lot of pressures to safeguard information, lock down information facing national security threats. On the other hand, we have Congress saying this is being used to shield information from lawful congressional oversight. These are somewhat inconsistent, but fascinating seeing how the push and pull of this plays out over time. Back to the audit. The audit assessed implementation of the program at 10 DOD components and 3 contractors. Most significantly, the IG found that DOD components did not effectively oversee the implementation of the instruction to ensure that CUI documents and emails contain required markings, that personnel complete required training as well. It went on from there. Contractor compliance was assessed more favorably. Of the 103 CUI documents assessed in the sample from 3 contractors, only 3% did not include CUI headers and footers, and only 1% did not include proper portion markings. However, the OIG found that DOD contracting officials did not consistently verify whether DOD contractors completed required CUI training. Overall, contractors had more uniformly implemented the CUI program as compared to DOD components, probably not a surprise given how much pressure the contractors have been under for so many years to get it together on the information protection side of life. Also relevant for contractors, OIG requested that DOD provide additional comments within 30 days describing their plans for developing a DFARS clause to require all DOD contractor personnel to complete CUI training. Contractors should expect continued regulatory developments and attention impacting the implementation of the CUI program at DOD and at all federal agencies. Well, that was a mouthful. So with that, we should close this podcast edition. Thank you for joining us for the Government Contracts Legal Roundup. If you have any questions or need any more information about anything I discussed here at Lightspeed, I can be reached at 202-639-6040 or drobbins with two B's at jenner with two N's.com. Thank you so much.